Art of Agile Development with James Shore.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host for helping you and your teams move fast, deliver quality, and run your software with confidence in Azure, all while using everything the .NET ecosystem has to offer. This podcast is sponsored by ClearMeasure, a software architecture company that empowers .NET teams to be self-sufficient and able to deliver world-class results. ClearMeasure is hiring architects, as well as .NET engineers who'd like a path to become an architect. So go to clearmeasure.com/careers for that. And also be sure to check out the new video show, Architect Tips. So today on the podcast, my guest is James Shore, and he teaches, writes, and consults on Agile software development. He is the co-author of the classic Agile how-to guide, The Art of Agile Development, which just put out the second edition. And he's also a co-creator of the Agile Fluency Model, a highly regarded guide for Agile adoption. And he's a recipient of the Agile Alliance's Gordon Pask Award for contributions to Agile practice. Well, James, welcome to the show. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. And congratulations for the second edition of the book that's out now, available for purchase.
Yeah, it is. It was a lot of work. It was over a year of nearly full-time work. So I'm very happy to see it out and in print. And now people can read it. And I hope they like it.
Fantastic. Now, there's some people, of course, who read the first edition and are getting the second edition. But for the people who might not be familiar with your work and in your career, what are the high points kind of along the way? And how'd you get here, your journey as a programmer?
Right. Yeah. So I got started. So I am a programmer. I am also obviously an author, but mostly I'm a programmer. And I got my start back in the 90s, early 90s. And I've always been interested in what makes it possible to create great software. I think it goes back. I was one of those introverted geeks that was writing D&D character creators on their Apple II in the 80s, right? And I had this experience. I was, as you must as a young geek, writing a D&D character creator. I was writing this on my Apple II and AppleSoft Basic. And slinging variables and go sub and go to, because this was an old school BASIC where you could have variables as long as you wanted, but only the first two letters really meant anything. So I was slinging these variables, and literally from one moment to the next, I don't know, maybe I got called for dinner or something, I went from having it all in my head, knowing that CL string meant class in BASIC. For those of you who don't remember, $ meant string. CL string meant class, and RA string meant race, and line 10,000 meant this subroutine, and line 10,500 meant that subroutine. Had it all in my head, and then literally from one moment to the left, next, it fell apart. Like, it all just vanished out of my head, and I couldn't get it back. I could not figure out how to work on this program anymore. And from that moment forward, I was like, well, what is it that makes it possible to do a big program and remember all this stuff? So I got super interested in design. I got super interested in process. In the 90s, of course, the dominant process was stage-based processes. People call them waterfall. Very end of that was spiral. And I decided I want to do these like as close to by the book as I could. So I went and I learned out about use cases, and I worked at a company using Rational Rose, which was a case tool, computer aided software engineering. And, we did waterfall. I mean, we didn't call it waterfall. I think, I don't remember what we called it, but we did it, you know, by the book as by the book as it could possibly be. Mm-hmm. And the more by the book we did it, the worse it was. And so I had a company that I was at a company that actually imploded from this. We were trying to sell, robotic control software for chip fabs to Intel, and we built something using this waterfall approach and CORBA and all this distributed object stuff. And we got to the point where we finally were integrating after months, years of work. And it didn't work because fundamentally we got a core design idea wrong, which is that the way we were distributing the application. And we didn't find this out until the end because we didn't try to integrate till the end, which is how the best minds said you should develop software at that time. I shouldn't say the best minds, how some minds said you should develop software. It was widely understood to be a good
thing. A lot of minds.
Yeah. So I broke my understanding of the world. And I said, there's got to be another way. And so I started looking around and I found something called feature-driven development, and which was one of the earliest agile methods. And that led me to extreme programming, which was the first really popular agile method. And I said, this is ridiculous. Like, there is so much dumb stuff here. How could anybody ever expect this to work? They had the ideas like pair programming. Well, that's, I mean, dumb. And they had evolutionary design. So we're not going to design anything in advance, which was, you know, what was really well understood to be the best way. Instead, we're going to do the simplest thing that could possibly work and evolve from there. So this cannot possibly work. So I'm going to try it and find out. And I did. And it was amazing. It worked so well. That was in 2001 when I had the experience with extreme programming, when that experience ended. And I was like, I've got to do this more. It works so well. It works so much better than this other stuff, the fusion method that I've been using or the other methods out there. And who else is doing this? Because I was a contract programmer at the time. Who can I work for? Crickets. Nobody. Nobody was doing it. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna teach people how to do this. And I got people to hire me first as a contractor. And I went through this really painful experience of trying to change an organization from as a grassroots programmer from the bottom up with mixed success. And then I got, you know, I hung out my consulting shingle and spent a couple of years trying to figure out how to get clients. That's really hard. And got clients and had my first real change effort where I worked from the top down and the bottom up at the same time. And that worked. And we taught them XP and they stuck with it for years and years and years. And then I moved on to the next one and the next one. And now here I am over 20 years later, still doing it, still loving that XP stuff. It's really all about how do we make creating great software feasible and fun. And that's what I do today.
Well, one of the practices that's actually mainstream today, even for programmers just starting out, is test-driven development. They might not know that it came from extreme programming, or maybe even before then.
It came from extreme programming, and Kent Beck, of course, was a creator of extreme programming, and he and Ward Cunningham, famously the inventor of the wiki web, the inspiration of Wikipedia and all these other wikis, of course. He and Ward Cunningham were working at Tektronix here in Portland, which happens to be my hometown. And they paired together a lot, and they developed this test-driven development, test-first programming thing. And then I don't know exactly whose idea it was first. I think it's typically attributed to Kent. And then Kent brought that in to extreme programming.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, I'd love to get into the high points that you've kind of spent the last couple of years on with your second edition of the book, because certainly some of the people who have, you know, over 20 years may remember some of the forces in the 90s of big process. But then again, people coming in today, and to some extent, there's pockets that have taken Agile to the quote, no process extreme of just basically, hey, programmer, go ahead and do this. When are you going to have it done? Okay, see you then. Mm-hmm. So obviously neither one is
right.
Where you want to be. So what are the mainstays from the first edition to the second edition that you've seen? Okay, a lot of time has passed, but these things aren't changing.
Yeah, so the first edition of the book came out in 2007, late 2007. And the second edition is coming out now in late 2021. So it has been 14 years between editions. And the first edition back in 2007, a lot of people had heard about Agile, but still weren't a lot of people doing it. It sort of gotten past the early adopter stage, and now people were starting to adopt it for real, what we call it early majority. And so the first edition of the book was all written about, well, how do you do this for real? Well, now 14 years later, everybody's heard of Agile, right? Everybody's doing Agile. Well, actually, they're not. they're not. We got two things. Either people are being, you know, said, okay, we're Agile, which means you need to just, you know, tell us when you're going to be done and go off and do it. And of course, that's not what Agile is all about. Or the thing that sort of breaks my heart is they're using it as an excuse for micromanagement, right? We've got somebody that we're going to call a scrum master or a product owner, and they're going to tell you what to do and when, and you're going to work for 2 weeks and we're going to check in on you every day. And that's not Agile either. So the second edition of the book is written to sort of take back Agile, say, okay, you've heard about Agile. There's all this misinformation out there about what Agile is, but that's not what Agile is. So let's talk about what is the underlying ideas behind Agile. What do you need in order to be successful with it? And then let's spend a lot of pages saying, well, practically, what does that mean? How do you really do this for real? Of course, one of the things about Agile is you adapt it for your local circumstance. So this is, how do you get started in a way that's super rigorous, but also changeable to your situation? So, I would say that core idea of what Agile is and how does it work has not changed between the editions, but the whole book has basically been rewritten from the ground up with this audience of, you got a lot of people telling you what Agile is. Most of them have never experienced it before. If you're feeling micromanaged, if you're feeling like you've been dropped off the side of a cliff and given no help, this book will show you how to do it well, to really create great software, have a good time doing it.
Well, that last part, that's so many programmers get into the field because they kind of do it on their own and it's fun.
Yeah. And programming is tons of fun.
And then some companies make work as opposed to still keeping it fun.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to say that there's never going to be things that you don't want to do, but if you're not able to focus on your work, if you find that you're spending tens of minutes or even hours every day fighting with your build system or your debugger or getting to the point where you can just check that your work is done, Mike Hill calls that GAC, geek at keyboard. If you're spending your time trying to get things to the point where you can be productive instead of actually being productive, something has gone horribly, horribly wrong somewhere. And it is solvable. But there's all this baggage that companies have where they get to the point where they don't even know it's solvable, right? Okay. But it is possible. That first XP project I was on, we did real programming work day in, day out for weeks at a time without the meetings, without the interruptions, without the fighting the build system. We were just productive,
yeah,
day after day after day after day for months.
Yep. Now, I'd like to ask a question that probably a lot of people who've been through Scrum training, which is everywhere. I think it's chapter 7. You talk about teamwork and the structure of the team, and even way back in the Mythical Mammoth book, Fred Brooks talks about the surgical team model, and then Scrum talks about, you know, product owner and Scrum Master, and then quote team. So in your view, and just of course the way that the industry has evolved, is there anything you can say about what an Agile team looks like structurally? If a manager is saying, okay, what roles? Just tell me what roles. How should they think about that?
So there's two answers to this. There's the answer that you need to get started when you're learning, because when you're learning, you need sort of hard and fast rules. That's how people learn best. And then there's the real answer, which is after you've had some practice, you let go of those hard and fast rules. You start experimenting with breaking the rules, and then eventually you realize the rules where they're just, we're just there to get you started and the rules don't matter at all. Some people call it a shuhari or apprentice journeyman master. It's also a variant of it. It's called the Dreyfus language or the Dreyfus learning model. But the fundamental idea is that, yeah, you need rules to get started. And so if I were to give you the simple, easy to understand and wrong rules to get started, it would be that, yeah, on an agile team, what we have is we want to have a collaborating team that's self-organizing to figure out how to do their own work. And this requires a variety of skills. We need people with development skills. We need people with product management skills, so business skills. We need people with operational skills. And we need people with testing skills. We could call each of those sets of skills a role, and that wouldn't be a terrible place to start. Or we could recognize that some people have some business skills, some development skills, some operation skills, and some testing skills. Not everybody. So a great agile team is going to have a mix of these skills. It's going to be a team founded on mutual respect and trust, where when the business expertise is needed, the team knows who to defer to because they've got the most business expertise. When operation skills are needed, the team knows who to defer to because they have the most operational expertise. And everybody has the ability to pitch in to help out those folks as needed.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at a team of, depending on how you decide to do the work, somewhere between 3 and 8 to 10 people. You can go even bigger than that, but that's hard. I wouldn't recommend it for folks starting out. I think if you're starting out, you're looking at between 3 and 8 people, probably less if you're not doing pair programming and more if you are doing pair programming. And a mix of skills according to what the organization is willing to allow the team to take ownership of, that is able to really own the problem and solve it on their own, doing their own task management, their own build automation, as much of their own operations as possible, as much of their own testing as possible, as much as their own business development as possible. And how much of that you can do depends a lot on what the organization is ready to let you do and what kind of skills and expertise you have on the team. So I don't know if that answered your question or not.
There's a few things that that seem a big departure from what's common today. You mentioned product management. You also mentioned not just tester, but an operations person. It seems that perhaps even the term development team is short-sighted if it's used in a way that means a team of just developers.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Agile, I think, so Agile is this big sort of fuzzy philosophy. It's not a method, right? And this is something that I think people get confused about. They think, well, Agile is this Scrum thing that was forced upon me at company X that I used to work at, and it was terrible and I hated it. That's not what Agile is. Agile is a philosophy of software development. It's a way of thinking about how software development can be done well. It's really characterized by 40 some odd words that you can find at agilemanifesto.org. And a list of 12 principles that go along with it. That's really all Agile is. All these methods, Scrum, SAFe, extreme programming, these are different ways of living that philosophy. So I think I've sidetracked myself.
Yeah, fine.
But so I guess what I'm saying is just because you've seen something that was called Agile, you didn't see but if it didn't follow that philosophy, then you weren't really doing something called Agile.
Yeah.
And, oh, I got it. And one of the core ideas of Agile is people with business expertise and development expertise, engineering expertise, working together to create a product that melds their two types of expertise. And so if you've got a team that is nothing but developers taking orders from somebody outside the team, it's probably not an Agile team because that's not what Agile's all about.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery.
Yeah, not to hate to sound like one of the old guys, but you know, early in my career, the first experiences were just effectively with a small number of programmers being embedded in just a regular department of a company, and they needed software. And to the extent that certain features weren't there yet, we had to do the work that the software was destined to do. And then once the software came online, that work, you know, 90% of it shrunk because it was automated, as opposed to what we see today is IT departments. And so even from an HR or management chain, you got management chains of developers and then development manager. And then at some point you've got, in the big companies, vice president of something. And then, okay, now it goes over to a vice president of what the company actually does for its own customers. And then they have employees. And then, and so it's kind of like the leaf nodes of that organization structure are then told to interact with the leaf nodes of the IT organization, as opposed to just organizing the company and giving operational teams a few developers.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a really tough organizational problem too, because I work with a lot of executives in the work I do. To really see Agile succeed, I think you need to have both top-down support and bottom-up support. And as a consultant who's been doing this a while and has, you know, has a book out and a couple of books now, I suppose, same two versions of the same book, I suppose, is the correct way of putting that. You know, people reach out to me because they know they've heard about me, they know who I am. So it tends to come from the executives. And so I understand where they're coming from. I understand how this is a hard organizational problem. Do you organize by function, or do you organize by you know, the mix of work? And neither one is really obvious. But I can tell you that in order for the work to be successful, those two types of people have to come together regardless of who they report to. And I would say that when you have the type of structure you're talking about, where the management chains are completely separate, it's very common, not universally true, but it's really common for there to be turf wars and for those two perspectives to not be able to get together. And this is why I think we see fake Agile, or as I call in the book, cargo called Agile, because you've got developers or development managers who say, we want to do Agile, not necessarily understanding what that means, but no buy-in from their counterparts, their business partners. And so they start saying, well, we're going to be Agile, and what we're going to do? We're going to do sprints, and we're going to do stand-ups. But the fundamental thing about Agile is that we're collaborating. But we can't collaborate because we don't have the authority to make that happen. Mm-hmm. And so you get the cargo call.
Yeah. Now, another big discussion point over the years is all about planning. And one of the big things is the question of, okay, we got a lot of work to do. When is it going to be done? And then it comes back to, okay, well, do I have to estimate? I need to have some answer for when do we think that we're going to be done? What do you see as some of the cargo cult or fake Agile practices under there versus how people really should be thinking about that?
Well, I'm not going to tell you how you should think. What I am going to tell you is how the Agile philosophy works. And if what your company wants doesn't match this philosophy, then Agile's not the right solution. Although you can use a lot of Agile ideas and not use this part of Agile, because this is a really hard one. So Agile is, Martin Fowler sort of summarized Agile in two pithy statements. And I really like it. That's pithy, not pissy, by the way. Pithy, succinct statements. And he says that Agile is people-oriented, not process-oriented, which means that we trust that the people are the most important aspect of being successful with software development. The process exists in service of the people, whereas historically in the 90s, it was really people in service of the process. And then the other thing is that Agile is adaptive, not predictive. In other words, when we learn new things, we change our plans rather than saying exactly what we're going to do at what point. And that's sort of in a vacuum, that makes a lot of sense. When you learn new things, you want to change your plans accordingly. But Agile goes a little bit further than that. It says that learning new things and adapting our plans is an unalloyed good. It is good when we learn something that invalidates our plans and we make a better plan. Not just change it for the sake of changing it, but when we see a way to make things better, we want to change our plans. That is fundamentally incompatible with making a fixed date and time prediction, because you don't know what you might learn in the future. If you did, then you wouldn't be learning it. You'd already know it, right? Mm-hmm. So Agile done well is adaptive. Agile done well doesn't know exactly what's going to happen and when. It just knows that you're going to try to learn and change. That's really, really hard for a lot of organizations. And so it is possible to have an Agile team that is Agile in other ways, but not adaptive, that is predictive, or is, it's really a spectrum. So a lot more predictive than adaptive. Maybe you're predictive for the next 6 months, but adaptive after that. Whereas a really, you know, bleeding edge Agile team might be adaptive, predictive for the next 2 weeks, and then adaptive after that. So, you know, not getting to the nuts and bolts of it, an ideal Agile team is going to emphasize that adaptive aspect, but you can still be predictive in an otherwise Agile team.
So some business executives might hear that statement and say, you're telling me that there's no way for me to announce anything to our customers. And I would, just lending some of my own experience, because I've kind of wrestled with this over time, it seems that adapting scope tends to be where a lot of the thought comes in, as opposed to suggesting changes to the business objective.
Yeah. Well, if you never change your business objective, either you've got perfect understanding of what your business objective should be, or you're limiting your opportunities. But like I said, it is possible to be more predictive in an Agile team. And one of the ways to do that is sort of what you're alluding to here, which is you can say, well, we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but we know that this is our objective. And we know that it's important that we release on this date. And that, I would say, is probably the most effective way of doing forecasting in a team, is to say, well, we will ship in this on this date. We will ship, and we will work on the most important thing first. We might do a little bit of estimating slash prediction so that we can know approximately what the minimum is we can get in there, and then everything else, you know, we'll polish from there, or add delighters or more value if we can fit it in. So yeah, I say if you have to do forecasting, and you don't always have to, but if you have to do forecasting, then forecasting according to, by picking a date and then adjusting scope to meet that date, is the best way to do it. That does require what I call delivering fluency. There's multiple types of Agile fluency. This is the Agile fluency model that Dinah Larson and I created. There are multiple ways of being fluent with Agile. And we've divided them up into sort of three major categories, which are focusing, delivering, and optimizing. Delivering fluency is the one that gives you the ability to work in small chunks and basically stop at any time and have something worth shipping. So if you're going to do a fixed date variable scope, you've got to do it in a way where you can, on that date, you can stop and ship everything you've had without having to worry about, oh, we've got a bug that we just can't squash and it's going to take us 2 weeks to fix it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, there's a shifting gears into practices. There's a lot of time that's happened since the Agile Manifesto, and it doesn't really mention any concrete software engineering practices. And of course, 2006, a book on continuous integration came out, and then 2010, people started talking about this thing called DevOps. Are there any engineering practices that, in your opinion, should be considered kind of rule of thumb for a team employing Agile?
Yes and no. Again, there's multiple levels of fluency, multiple zones of fluency, as we call them. And you can pursue all three of them simultaneously or one at a time. And the teams pursuing the focusing zone, they're the ones who are working out how to focus on the most important thing first, how to adapt their plans. Engineering practices are really important to support that, but you can develop fluency in that zone without the engineering practices.
Okay.
Then there's the delivering zone of fluency, which is about the ability to deliver reliably and at whatever point the business wants. So basically ship at a moment's notice and be confident that it will have high quality. For that, yeah, you absolutely need a whole lot of engineering practices. And I'll get into it in just a second. And then the third zone is optimizing. That's really about truly being adaptive in your plans, having that business development as part of the team, which most teams don't start out with. So you can be agile without that. I've been sort of taking a hard line in some of this conversation, but it's all about adapting to what your organization is comfortable and will let you do. But if you're going to pursue that delivering fluency, which, you know, as a programmer myself, I think is where you get the best results, focusing and delivering fluency together. If you're going to pursue that delivering fluency, then yeah, there's a couple of things that I would start with. Well, more than a couple. I would start with test-driven development. I would start with some sort of ability to collaborate as a team on the same code base. So not something like pair programming or mob programming and collective ownership. I would start with the ability to merge your code into a common code base every couple of hours. Continuous integration. I hesitate to use the term continuous integration because it's been misunderstood so badly.
That's right.
It's not a server. It's a way of working. It's about merging your code together into the same branch every couple of hours. I would use evolutionary design. So that's the ability to change your design regardless of how your plans change. Have the ability to cleanly evolve your design to support that. I would include building for operation. So understanding what it takes for your software to be successful in actual operation, not just on development machines, and that stuff like logging, alerting, monitoring, observability, security, privacy. How are you going to deal with all those things? And I would include incident analysis and bug reduction. And these are all things that I've got in part three of my book, which is not just, you know, Scrum type stuff, but also how do you make this really, really feasible from an engineering perspective? Because without that, eventually it all falls apart.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Another concept that seems to be talked about a lot that I've noticed is this notion of Kanban. Is that just something that people may use, or is that more often than not used together with other agile way of thinking?
Well, Kanban's a complicated word. There is the Kanban, which is a Japanese word meaning sign or logo, sort of both, which is where it originally comes from. There's the Kanban, which is a sign that's used to order parts on a Toyota production system assembly line, which is manufacturing, and in lean manufacturing, which is based on Toyota production system. And then in software development, there is the idea of Kanban that came from lean and Toyota production system. And there's the Kanban method that David Anderson created. So Kanban is a complicated word. But usually when people say Kanban, what they really mean is a continuous flow system, which means that we are going to limit the work in process. We're going to limit the number of things that we're working on at a time. And we're going to pull from upstream when we identify new work. And often they'll create a sort of overly complicated series of swim lanes to visualize how the work is flowing through the system. That tends to lead in the direction of a waterfall phase-based approach. Like we're going to do the requirements analysis lane, and then we're going to do the development lane, and then we're going to do the test lane, and then we're going to do the put in production lane. I think for a team that has delivering fluency, what we want to do is see a phase-less approach where we are doing the testing and the design and the requirements analysis and the development more or less in parallel rather than a one stage at a time. And if that sounds impossible, well, please get a copy of my book because I describe how to do it in the book. But setting that all aside, if we think of Kanban as continuous flow, then that makes a lot of sense. There's really two planning styles. There's iteration or sprint-based planning, and then there's continuous flow planning. Sprint-based planning or iteration-based planning, we say we're going to work for a week, or we're going to work for 2 weeks, and we're going to work on this bucket of stories that we are going to sign up to and commit to completing to the best of our ability within that time. Then we treat that as a strict time box. If we don't finish it, something has gone wrong somewhere. And the continuous flow approach says, well, we're going to work on no more than 3 stories at a time, or whatever the number is. And whenever one is done, then we'll take the next one in.
Mm-hmm.
Both have their pluses and minuses. And I do talk about what those pluses and minuses are in the book. For a team that's new, I'd recommend starting with this iteration or sprint-based approach, because that strict time box allows you to learn about where the flaws in your approach are. Because if you should be able to say we can do this much in the next 2 weeks and then finish it. And if you can't, that means that something about your development system has gone awry, and there's an opportunity to fix that. And the Kanban approach, or the continuous flow approach, doesn't make that quite as obvious.
Yeah. Yeah. And as we close, probably a timely shift, there's been a lot of, over the years, agile teams and even others, maybe not even in software, kind of going from offices or cubicles to touting, oh, here's my open layout, or here's my war room, and here's everybody together kind of around a conference table, or let's push all the desks together so we're physically co-located into a room, and then boom, tons of more people are working from home. So what's your perspective on how a team where, okay, now our reality is every single person is physically miles away. What should they be doing?
Well, this has been, this has been a real shock to a lot of companies. And I think some of them are still grappling with the idea that, no, I don't think people are going to go back into the office, not for something like software development, which can feasibly be done remotely. It's obviously different if you're in a butcher shop or if you're in a retail environment where you have to physically be there. Or in a manufacturing line. But yeah, for software development, I don't know that we're going to have people going back to the office. I think some people will want it, but I don't know if there's going to be enough to make it happen. Jury's still out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even before the pandemic, I was never a fan of these big open plan offices because you get the noise pollution, right? The fundamental idea in Agile is that we want to have a team of people who are working well together, collaborating really closely. And the ideal physical environment for that is the team room, where just the people on the team are in the same location and they have walls and a door to block out noise from people who are outside the team. So that when you overhear something, it's related to what you're working on. And you have the best offices I ever saw was actually at Spotify in, where was that? Was it Stockholm? Anyway, it was in Europe. And they had this environment where the cubicles were isolated and they had a private room in each team room where if you had a distracting call or a private conversation, you could go in there and shut another door and not disturb the rest of your team.
Mm-hmm.
So team room is the idea of physical environment. You also need that if you're remote and virtual. You need a virtual team room. That means that you need a team chat. You need a team teleconference of some sort. You need to have working agreements about how you're going to work together effectively. And you really, really need a virtual whiteboard of some sort, such as Miro.com or Mural.com. And if you have those things, you can make a virtual team room. And it's harder to be really effective in a virtual team room than a physical team room, but it's easier to be effective when you have a properly set up virtual team room where you're thinking of it as this is our shared workspace and you're very intentional about it. It is much easier to do that than being physically in the same office, but in cubicles or open plan or virtual equivalent of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a tough and worldwide transition, seems like.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Well, for people who are kind of want to chomp at the bit and learn more, they can obviously buy your book, but you're doing some other things. You're doing book clubs. What are the other things that are going on that people can latch onto?
Yeah. So if you go to my website, jamesshore.com, and you look down on the front page, you'll see either up in the navigation bar or on the front page, you'll see a link to the book and you can click that and go find the book homepage. And it will basically tell you everything you want to know. It'll show you where you can buy the copy of the book. It will show you a link to the Discord server we have, where there's just these amazing conversations going on. It'll tell you about the weekly book clubs we're doing, where we're getting some really experienced people coming and sharing their stories about what Agile is like. And we're sort of working our way through the various concepts in the book. I'm also recording those and putting them up on YouTube afterwards, so you can watch them at double speed or wherever you like to do these things. But yeah, it all starts by going to jamesshore.com, clicking the books link in the top, or finding the picture of the book down lower on the page. If you wanted to join the Discord directly, though, you could go to jamesshore.com/s/AOAD2Discord. That's Art of Agile Development 2 Discords, D-I-S-C-O-R-D. Or you can buy a copy of the book by going to jamesshore.com/s/buy-AOAD2. And these are just redirect links that will take you right there. But the easiest way is probably just go to the homepage and look for the book and find the book homepage.
Nice, nice. Awesome. Well, hey, congratulations again on getting the second edition of the book out and the book club and the Discord server, and thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, my pleasure. You know, I really appreciate you giving me a chance to talk about the book. Worked really hard on it. I'm super proud of it. I think it came out great. Yeah,
you should be. It's a big accomplishment.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks again.
Yeah, thank you.
And dear listener, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.